This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to take you to the frontiers of cancer therapy. We're going to talk to a luminary in this field, a revolutionary thinker who has some forward-thinking and highly controversial views on the way we should treat cancer. We gave you a preview of this in some recent podcasts where we talked about ketogenic diet for cancer. Today we're going to talk to one of the foremost proponents of ketogenic diet for cancer. He's Dr. Thomas Seyfried. He is renowned in the field of cancer research, and he was recently featured in the New York Times Magazine in a fascinating article entitled "An Old Idea, Starve Cancer to Death." And this is an article that really got a lot of hits in the Times, so it's actually very propitious that we have him on shortly thereafter to provide a more in-depth account of his views on cancer as a metabolic disease. His findings show that a combination of ketogenic diet, sometimes accompanied by hyperbaric oxygen therapy, can work synergistically without major side effects to fight cancer. And it's an old idea that's reborn. Dr. Seyfried is a professor of biology at Boston College and author of the book Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, which is, well, it's a book for enlightened lay people, but actually it's a very, very profound and technical scientific treatise, very lengthy and detailed, which details why he thinks that we may have taken a wrong turn in our approach to cancer and that there may be better ways to go about it. So without further ado, here's Dr. Seyfried. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Well, thank you very much, Ron. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, okay, so this is not a new idea. This is actually an old idea that dates back to a German scientist named Otto Warburg, the winner of a Nobel Prize. So how is it that this old idea is being resurrected?
Well, I mean, he had studied a series of tumors with some very sophisticated biochemical techniques at that time, and these techniques are still considered effective in analyzing tumor metabolism. And he found that basically all the different kinds of tumors that he looked at had a propensity to produce large amounts of lactic acid, lactate, a breakdown product of glucose metabolism. Actually, we call it lactic acid fermentation. But the interesting observation was that this was being produced in the presence of oxygen. And it's well known in biochemistry that many cells to stay alive will ferment lactic acid in low oxygen levels. It's just part of staying alive. Some cells can do this for long periods of time. Other cells can do it for short periods of time. But usually when oxygen comes back into the environment, the production of lactic acid usually disappears, and that's referred to as the Pasteur effect, discovered and elucidated by Louis Pasteur. But the strange thing about the tumor cells was, as Warburg noted, they continued to produce lactic acid even in the presence of oxygen, which is an anomaly. It shouldn't happen. And then he went on to ask, you know, how is this happening? How does a tumor, why a tumor continues to produce this this waste product that should be fully oxidized, yet it's dumped out into the microenvironment. How is it? What's responsible for this behavior? And he concluded that the respiratory capacity of the tumor cell was in some way inefficient or abnormal, and this abnormality ultimately led to this inefficient use of fuel, which was in his studies was mostly glucose. So then that was recognized by more and more scientists that yes, many, many tumors, almost all tumors, not all, but almost all do produce this lactic acid. And then it set off a whole response. What is responsible? And Warburg clearly said and provided hard evidence to show that this was due to abnormalities in the mitochondria. And this is where the controversy is today. Because if Warburg is right, that this is a mitochondrial problem that makes efficient energy in our cells, then this is where the focus is. The origin of cancer is due to dysfunctional respiration. The cells then ferment. So therefore, the cells will have a greater use for fermentable fuels. And therefore, if we can target the availability of fermentable fuels, we can develop non-toxic therapies for cancer.
And this is quite a contrast to our current paradigm for dealing with cancer, because this is metabolic medicine as opposed to what's termed molecular biology, where they target some specific sequence, or they do a genetic analysis on a tumor, and they try to fire a magic bullet to interrupt the growth of the cancer. But this is a different kind of approach that attempts literally to starve the cancer and maybe more generalized over many cancer types.
Yes, I mean, this is it's a singular disease of energy metabolism. So regardless of where the tumors come from, whether it's the brain, the breast, the colon, the bladder, these cells manifest a common pathophysiological problem. They ferment. So in the presence of oxygen. So they shouldn't do this. So the question then becomes, what are these cells using? Because the cell can't divide unless it has the capability of obtaining protein, lipid, and nucleic acid. They have to rebuild their DNA and their RNA. They have to build new proteins for enzymes, and they have to build cell walls, membranes. And this is all coming from the synthesis of these molecules. But in order to divide and develop and proliferate, they need an energy source. And the energy source for these tumor cells is in large part fermentation fuels. So then the question becomes, what do the cells use to, what are the fuels available for fermentation that can allow the cells to divide? And that becomes glucose and glutamine. Mm-hmm. And these two fuels are usually present in an abundance in the microenvironment of the tumor cells. So you can throw the kitchen sink at these tumor cells. And yes, you can kill a lot of them using very toxic radiation and poisonous chemicals. You will, in fact, kill many tumor cells because you're targeting the dividing DNA, and therefore you're blowing everything out. However, these cells can still survive as long as they have the availability of fermentable fuels. And we don't seem to be targeting the strategies that we're using today. Don't even know or don't even consider this as the possibility. So our view is that if you can remove these fermentable fuels, these tumor cells will die because there's no other available fuel in sufficient quantity in the microenvironment that would give enough fuel for these cells to divide. The really disturbing problem is that many of the standards of care for cancer, high-dose radiation and chemicals, damage the local microenvironment, freeing up these fermentable fuels. And oftentimes steroids are used to reduce inflammation, which elevates blood glucose levels. And so in other words, the things that we're doing to manage cancer today are in part counterproductive to the overall well-being and success of the therapies.
And we have some modern clues as to the potential of this therapy, clues that weren't around in the time of Otto Warburg, who basically wrote in the 30s and 40s. We have the PET scan. What does the PET scan tell us about glucose utilization by cancer cells?
Well, you know, the PET scan, one has to be careful about that, because in some of the inflammatory conditions, normal cells will be taking up more glucose as well as tumor cells. But, you know, people often refer to the PET scan as evidence that the tumor cells are utilizing an amount of glucose, because you use fluorodeoxyglucose as your marker for allowing the instrument to detect the foci of tumor cells that seem to be taking in more glucose. And in some ways, this is an example of the need, or the utilization, I should say, of an excessive amount of glucose, because you're collecting the marker, you're collecting the non-metabolizable glucose analog in the tumor cells, and now this is giving you a signal that's picked up in the PET scan. And you see it in a greater extent in those cells that are differentially expressing or having a differential need for glucose relative to the less the cells, the normal cells in the micro, in the background cells that are not using glucose to the same extent. And this separates then the metastatic cancer cells, those that have spread to different organs, from the local background. Yes, so that's one indication, but it's not the only indication.
And where there's also now the mainstreaming of metformin or glucophage as a means of preventing or as an adjunctive therapy for cancers. And that's something that also works on sugar metabolism.
Well, that's complicated. Metformin, we think, working primarily by stressing the mitochondrial, the little mitochondrial function that the tumor cells have, we think that metformin is working through creating maybe reactive, a little bit more reactive oxygen species. Metformin cannot get blood glucose down
sufficiently
to the levels, mm-hmm. yeah, that would be needed to actually kill tumor cells by starving them of glucose. It seems that metformin may act as a mild mitochondrial poison that the cancer cells might be a little bit more susceptible to than the normal cells. But you're not going to resolve cancer by metformin by itself.
So the answer is not just reducing sugar, you know, maybe a lower carb diet, but a more extreme version, which is the ketogenic diet. So talk to us about that.
Well, the ketogenic diet is one strategy, one therapeutic strategy that can target the availability of glucose. And when the glucose, because you can push glucose levels down, everything depends, I should say a lot depends on maintaining brain function. And
right.
The brain is uses the majority of the glucose. It's the singular largest consumer of glucose in our body. But we evolved as a species to transition away from glucose or carbohydrate to a fat-based diet. But the fats themselves cannot be used by the brain. But the brain breaks the fats down into ketone bodies, which are water-soluble fat breakdown products. And the brain then can replace glucose and use ketone bodies as an alternative fuel. So if the brain can remain functional, you can push blood sugars down, because the rest of the cells in the body will also use these ketone bodies or fats. The heart and some other organs will use fatty acids. So you can shift the energy metabolism in the body away from carbohydrate to fat or fat breakdown products. And the tumor cells have a great difficulty using ketone bodies for energy, because they have defective respiration. So they require basically glucose and glutamine, which is an amino acid. And together, these two fuels will keep these tumor cells alive. But the ketogenic diet is one half of the solution, and that is, if we can starve them of their carbohydrate source and starve them of their glutamine source, then these tumor cells should be unable to grow. They will die. They should not be able to grow as fast, and could potentially lead to the resolution.
And you keep mentioning glutamine, and glutamine is actually sometimes used as a nutritional supplement. It's sometimes used even in cancer care because it's thought to be something that can help to repair the gastrointestinal tract in patients who have GI side effects from chemotherapy. It's actually on hospital formularies. You're saying that using glutamine as a supplement could potentially feed cancer?
We know that glutamine is given, yes, but not only for the reasons that you just stated, but also to rebuild the immune system from the damage from the treatments that were given to the individuals. And we and others have shown that the metastatic cell, the cell that spreads through your body, that eventually leads to the majority of deaths, either from the spread of the tumor cells or the toxic treatments used to try to kill these cells. These cells are part of our immune system. They are fused macrophage hybrids. They arose in the original tumor site in their attempts to heal the growing inflamed region around the tumor. These cells naturally use tremendous amounts of glutamine. So glutamine is a major fuel for not only the proliferation of these cells, but for the energy of these cells. And these cells evolve to use glutamine. They use glucose as well, but they have a tremendous demand for glutamine. So the question is, yes, glutamine is used as a supplement to rebuild a damaged digestive tract, to rebuild the immune system. And the question is, why are we doing that? Why would we treat any human being with a toxic drug that would cause digestive problems, hair loss, or any other kinds of things that would put this individual at risk for either recurrence of the disease or now for a whole series of new maladies that the person never had but for the fact that they were subjected to these toxic therapies. So if you know that the metastatic cell is using glucose and glutamine to survive, isn't it more logical to try to go after these molecules than to try to damage the proliferative DNA aspects of the cells, which is what most of these toxic drugs and radiation is doing?
Indeed. Well, so you're saying that, ketogenic diet, that might be a very low-carb diet with primarily fat as a fuel source, but surely some proteins are rich in glutamine. So the diet that you might recommend for a cancer patient might be specially adapted to provide protein in a form where glutamine is minimal?
Yeah, I mean, glutamine, it's so much easier for us to target the availability of glucose than it is for us to target the availability of glutamine. Glutamine is the most abundant amino acid in our body. It's a non-essential amino acid because we can get it from the diet, or we can actually synthesize it from glutamate.
Mm-hmm.
But it's played such an important role in the urea cycle and in ammonium transport and all this anaplerosis, anaplerotic in the different cells of our body that is providing nutrients for the synthesis of enzymes and things like this. So targeting glutamine is a little bit more tricky and challenging than is targeting glutamate or targeting glucose. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think if it's an insurmountable problem. I think this could be recognized, but very few people are focusing on this. So as you mentioned at the beginning, I mean, they're focusing on immunotherapies and targeted gene therapies and precision medicine. If we took all of that intellectual power and shifted it onto the right target, this problem would not be as nearly problematic as it is today. But there's just very few people focusing on this.
Well, you're not solely a proponent of diet therapy for cancer. You're not like, a Massachusetts version of the Hippocrates Institute, where you think, you know, patients should come, go and get on a ketogenic diet, and that's the sole answer to cancer. That's what I think I'm hearing you say.
Yeah.
You're also talking about using the diet, but also maybe developing medical strategies or perhaps nutritional supplement strategies which block these pathways that ultimately starve the cancer cell. And you're saying that some of these may be at hand and some of these are yet to be developed.
Yes. So it's the ketogenic diet, I've worked on this for a long time. I don't consider a cure for cancer. No, we have never published a paper saying the ketogenic diet will cure cancer. Does the ketogenic diet slow the problem? Yes, it does. Does it reduce inflammation? Yes, it does. It has a lot of, does it target angiogenesis? That's right. Yes, if it's done right. The ketogenic diet is a medical therapy. It's a medical food. It should have the same respect as any powerful drug, because it has that effect. But is it by itself going to resolve the cancer issue? I don't think so. Maybe a few people can get resolution with the diet alone, but I don't think most people will, and most of the people that we've encountered don't. But do they delay the tumor growth? Absolutely. But if we're going to resolve the cancer issue, it has to be a combination of both the diet used as a medicine, a diet as medicine, food as medicine, which is the concept of the Hippocrates strategy. But at the on the other hand, we need to work with drugs that work synergistically with this diet, and we have to create an environment that is non-toxic to the normal cells of the body. So this is why hyperbaric oxygen is viewed as a synergistic therapy that can be used with the ketogenic diet, and we are now beginning to explore a whole sequence and range of other add-ons, and I call this the press pulse strategy. I'm working on a manuscript now on this, and we use the diet as a press that puts the entire tumor cell population under a greater metabolic stress than the normal cells, and then we use a strategy of drugs that come together to target further glucose and glutamine availability, but it must be done in such a scheduling and sequence that it doesn't harm the patient. The key question is, can you achieve success and management of this disease without producing adverse side effects? That is the problem today for the majority of the cancer therapies. And the answer, I believe, is yes.
Indeed. Well, this is a good point at which to pause, because our listeners know that we divide our podcast into two parts, and we've laid the groundwork for a discussion of a ketogenic diet. And in part two of today's interview with Dr. Thomas Seyfried, we'll talk a little bit about some of these, as you say, these press pulse strategies, the use of adjunctive drugs, hyperbaric oxygen in conjunction with the ketogenic diet. We'll hone in a little bit on what is a ketogenic diet and what the resources are to help people follow it in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine podcast. So please join us as we continue our discussion with Dr. Thomas Seyfried. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.